Hey, this is Mark P. Fisher with Inspiring Growth, where we share stories of struggle that have led to growth. And this is actually Ron Hall Revisited. Ron is the author of Same Kind of Different as Me and Working Our Way Home. One a book, one a movie, both actually Same Kind of Different as Me was a movie and a book. But we're revisiting episode one of season one because Ron Hall now has the Ron Hall Show podcast. So if you like this conversation, jump over and subscribe to Ron Hall podcast. I think it's called the Ron Hall Show. Plus, churches, we want to let you know that Ron Hall's Same Kind of Different as Me is now available in a 33-minute version with comments from Ron that you can actually plug and play and show in your church to talk about betrayal, forgiveness, serving others, and racial reconciliation through friendship. If you're interested in that, go to samekindfoundation.org and watch the preview. Okay, I hope you enjoy the conversation with Ron Hall.
Didn't happen until a lot later. So we are really excited for you guys to hear this conversation. So without further ado, here's Ron's conversation with Mark.
Well, Ron, thanks for sitting down with me. This is Mark Fisher with Inspiring Growth. We're actually at Ron and Beth Hall's home in Dallas, Texas. And my wife, Lori, and I are hanging out. We're working on the Same Kind of Different as Me Foundation, which is, why don't you talk about the foundation? What is that all about?
Well, our foundation was inspired by our book and our story, Same Kind of Different as Me. And it came about as a result of me being, I guess, the unofficial czar for homelessness in America. Because I guess after our book, the success of our book, and then our film, I get calls all the time of people that have emergency needs as it relates to the homeless. So we decided to start a foundation that could be the 911 call and fulfillment center for emergency needs, especially in the areas where homelessness is underfunded, which is most of the world, but there are many missions that have a huge base of support, but then there are plenty of smaller missions that have virtually no support. So we would like to lift those people up and bless them when they have emergency needs.
Yeah, and I know with Denver's story, you know, you guys met in Fort Worth, but the mission there probably would not have given Denver a car like you gave him a car.
Well, of course not.
Because there's way too much liability in that.
Well, and there's not enough money to go around to give, you know, how many thousands of people on the streets a car.
So. Just to get to work. But so, well, as you know, Ron and I, as Ron knows, Inspiring Growth is really designed to inspire growth with leaders in their organizations. But the podcast is a way to share stories of struggle that have led to growth. And Ron, I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about the initial struggle that was sort of the seed of a ton of growth in your life, but it didn't happen with a Hollywood movie.
No. It happened long before that. I'd say in the mid-80s, I was riding on top of the world. I was a very successful art dealer, ran an international art business where I was selling millions and millions of dollars worth of very famous paintings to museums and large private foundations and collectors. My wife and I were both living a purpose-driven life, but my purpose in life was chasing after the almighty dollar. And her purpose in life was chasing after the Almighty God. And our lives took very different paths. And in fact, I went down a very slippery slope and decided on infidelity as the answer to our marital problems. And of course, you know,
that worked out for you.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, it worked out magnificent because my wife and her ability to connect with our Savior. And for her, and the passion that she had for God and what the Christianity is all about. You know, it's about forgiveness and it's about mercy. And she showed me the most incredible Christ-like forgiveness for that sin. And for that sin and for her forgiveness, I promised that I would do anything that she asked me the rest of our lives together.
Anything.
I said, anything you
ask.
Did
she know you had made that promise?
Yes. Yeah, I told her that. And no, so we rocked along for about another 10 years in a very beautiful marriage. We rebuilt our lives together. Our marriage was a picture perfect marriage of any, I thought it was the most perfect marriage that God ever ordained. Our friends were just like, what is going on with you guys? I've never seen a couple so happy, so committed. Everything, we were just so in love. And you know, we began to share common interests.
And wait a minute.
Of course, our spiritual.
This beautiful picture mm-hmm. was after the infidelity.
After the infidelity, after the forgiveness that she showed me. Mm-hmm. She was able to throw my sin as far as the east is from the west. Never to bring it up again. Never to bring it up again. And that's why I said, I will do anything you ask me.
Have you ever met people who hear that part of your story and go, I can't do that? Or
I've heard a lot of people, but you know, I have also heard from other women who said, I did that and it saved my marriage. Hmm. So I know that was an important part of our story. I know people focus on our story as helping the homeless. But there would have been no help for the homeless and no story apart from the forgiveness that she had shown me for my infidelity.
So talk about how her forgiveness caused growth for you.
Once she became a believer, then she took the ball and ran with it. And I just was then building a business, and she was raising our children, and she became the spiritual leader in our family. I abdicated that job in the pursuit of money. And so as of a few years later, you know, that wasn't working out so well in the marriage, though I had amassed what I said, a very comfortable amount of money that we could have easily lived the rest of our lives on with never having to work another day. So anyway, as a result of that, and I had a lot of I would say I was very arrogant about that time. I was very proud, very prideful person of what I had been able to accomplish. The fact that I had grown up in almost not an inner city, but a very, very poor section of the city. I used to tell people, and I grew up so poor, I couldn't even pay attention. And
as a fellow ADD guy, I can understand that.
Well, and you know, I was a self-made success. I started with a job as a paperboy at 8 years old, and I was the top paperboy in the city. Then I had several jobs that I worked three jobs in high school, and I was able to buy my own car when I was 14 years old and pay the insurance, and I put myself through college. I did all the kinds of things that most kids don't have a chance to do today.
Yeah.
But you know, those were different times, and my parents were not able to afford to do that.
Well, what's interesting, I remember you had invited me into dinner with Greg Kinnear, who played right. you in the sure. same kind of Different as Me movie. And I was talking to him, and he said, you know, the first time I met Ron, I told him it was a pleasure to meet you. And your response to him was something like,
well, that's the catfish calling the bullfrog big mouth, or what?
Something like that. So, or it's like, you didn't know me. You obviously don't know me.
Oh, well, yes, that's true. I might have said, yes, you obviously don't know the whole story.
So talk about the forgiveness and where that path of forgiveness led you as relates to Same Kind of Different as Me.
Well, the path of forgiveness led me into the greatest marriage, the happiest marriage that I could imagine. And, but, you know, I was still not really fulfilled in life. I was fulfilled in a career. We bought a ranch to enjoy being in the country together, and that was something that was very important to our marriage, to have a mutually shared interest.
And you called that ranch?
Rocky Top. And it was at Rocky Top where we really fell in madly in love again, and we had a very common interest and made friends there in our ranching community. But it was just a few years after we bought Rocky Top. We'd been, maybe had it 10 years when one night my wife had a dream. We were actually building a new home, which was my dream home. I had always wanted a big contemporary home to house our art collection. I was very proud of our art collection that I had built over 25, 30 years as an art dealer. And in this dream home, she began to dream. And the first night she dreamed there would be a homeless shelter built in Fort Worth, Texas, where our new dream home was. There would be a homeless shelter unlike any homeless shelter in America. It would be beautiful. It would be like a hotel where the clients there would be served new fresh foods cooked by a chef, and they would be sitting on new furniture, not the hand-me-downs, the things that that people put out on the curb and wait for the Salvation Army to pick them up. Mm-hmm. But they would be dressed in new clothes and not the hand-me-downs that are thrown into the bins for the missions to pick them up.
This is all in her dream.
This is all in her dream.
And when she told you this, what went through your mind?
Well, you know, she didn't really tell me this dream until after the second dream. So the next night she had another dream. And in this dream, she had she dreamed of a homeless man. She said he was a poor man who was wise, like a verse in Ecclesiastes, where they said there was found in the city a certain poor man who was wise, and by his wisdom the city was changed. But in her dream, she said, the city and our lives will be changed if we can find this man in her dream. So she asked me to go with her into the inner city of Fort Worth to look for the man of her dream. So that was actually the first thing that she had ever asked me to do outside just, you know, being a good husband and being faithful. Even though it was not something I wanted to do, I knew she wasn't crazy. So I said, okay, I'll accompany you with you. So we began driving around the inner city looking for this man in her dream, and we didn't see him the first day. So we stopped and volunteered at a homeless mission and told the people we would begin serving there regularly. And part of the plan was in hopes of finding the man of her dream. But the mission was all run down and nasty, and I did not want to be in this place. It smelled bad and all that. And I was telling her that. And she said, oh, but I dreamed of another more beautiful mission, that when our dream really comes true, when we find the man of our dream and all of these things, there will be a new mission built, and it will be unlike any mission in America. It will have even yellow flowers like our spring pastures at Rocky Top. And so she described to me this mission as when she was describing the man of her dream. So we had been there serving a couple of weeks, and I was getting over my, I guess, fear of being there.
Your phobia of dirt?
My phobia of, I was a germophobe, you might say, and I was very afraid of all the diseases that I might catch being in this place. And in fact, I asked the chef on the first day that I was there. They called him Chef Jim. He was just another homeless man, but he wore one of these big toques like a French chef wears. So, and I said, can you tell me what all the infectious diseases that may be floating around this place I need to know about? And he said, oh, absolutely. He said, let me tell you, we infect them all with love. That was kind of a smart aleck comment. But anyway, by that, he won me into his, friendship. And so, but we had been there a couple of weeks when we were serving an evening meal. And all of a sudden, this giant African-American man with no shirt and no shoes, and just some raggedy old unzipped breeches, burst into the dining room and starts turning over tables and screaming, I'm going to kill whoever done it. I'm going to kill whoever stole my shoes. And it was frightening to me, because all of a sudden there was mass pandemonium in the dining hall. He started beating up people and throwing people down on the ground. And he was screaming obscenities. And I was really...
Where were you?
I was behind the serving line getting ready to serve the evening meal. And so I decided that I could feel the fight moving my way, and so I decided to take a little hiding place down behind the serving line. And I had my head kind of stuck in there like an ostrich sticking his head in a hole. And all of a sudden I got to wondering, well, I wonder what happened to Debbie. So she was standing next to me, but I had totally was more concerned about myself. But all of a sudden I had a moment of clarity. Well, maybe I should check on her. So I pulled my head out and I looked up, and she was all excited, and she was jumping up and down like a cheerleader on the sideline of a football game. And she was saying, that's him. That's him. And I said, that's who? And she said, that's the man I had the dream about. And I said, which one? And she said, the one that's threatening to kill everybody. And then she looked down at me because I was still on my knees. And she said, and Ron, I believe I heard from God that you have to be his friend and find out if my dream was real. And I said, but Debbie, I was not at that meeting you had with God. And if I'm going to be friends with someone who wants to kill everybody, well, I think I should go talk to God myself. So I asked one of the homeless men who was serving next to us on the line, I said, "Who is that crazy man?" He said, "Well, a lot of people call him the Lion of the Jungle because he rules the streets with fear and intimidation, but no one really knows his name. But a lot of people just call him Suicide.
Suicide,
because messing with him is the equivalent of committing suicide." He said, "He's dangerous. He's crazy. He'll hurt you. You just need to keep away from him." And I said, "Well, thank you very much for that advice." So,
and that was the beginning of the story that's now a New York Times bestseller, Same Kind of Different as Me. It was on the bestseller list for over 3 years. And then
it made number one on the New York Times bestselling list.
And it's actually revisited since the movie came out in October. It's back up on the New York Times bestselling list. But that was really a relationship that, I guess, for me, when I've gone and I've served, I've often had a subconscious sense of, you know, I'm going to go help somebody. I'm going to help them because I've got more than they have, or I'm better than them, or, you know, they made stupid mistakes and I haven't, and so I'm going to hand them some food or something like that. That's not your story. That's not your story with Denver. Something happened to you more than happened to Denver. Talk about that.
Well, Denver, in Debbie's dream, Denver was a poor man who was wise, but I did not really understand his wisdom in the beginning, because I just saw him as a poor, angry, crazy man, and there was no wisdom coming there, because he would run from me. And I pursued him for 5 months at Debbie's insistence. You remember, she had, I had promised her I would do anything that she asked me. And every day she was asking me, "Please just take a drive through the inner city, see if you can get him in the car to find out if my dream is real." And so I continued to do what I had promised that I would do, to get him in my car and have a conversation to see if he really was a wise man who would change our city. And it took me 5 months to get him in the car. And we went to breakfast that morning. At the end of breakfast, he asked me, he said, "What is it you want from me?" He said, "You and your wife driving me crazy." He said, "Man, I've had no peace in my life since your skinny little wife showed up on the streets." He said, "Can't you tell that woman to leave me alone and get control of your woman?" And I said, "No, I can't get control of my woman." But I said, "Oh, I just want to be your friend." And he looked at me with this incredulous look, and he said, "You want to be my friend?" And I said, "That's it, straight up, man, I just want to be your friend." He said, "Man, I'm going to think about that." And I thought to myself, "Hey, buddy, you just looked a gift horse in the mouth. You do not know who you are talking to." I said, "I'm a millionaire. I can do anything for you. You are the man of my wife's dream, I think. And if she wants you to have new clothes, you got it. Car, I can do it. House, apartment, anything you want, I can do for you, because I've got everything and you have nothing. So you should be thankful that I want to be your friend and not just go thinking about it." So that's how arrogant I was. I thought he had nothing to offer me in a friendship. And if he behaved himself, I would be his benefactor and show him what it was like to be rich for a day and make him feel badly about himself, that he hadn't made the good choices in life that I had made to become successful. But I had no idea what homelessness and poverty and lack of education, all those things, I had no idea of those things, because I had everything.
You used a word right there, and I want you to pick up that story in the next chapter, but you used a word that I struggle with. You were going to do it for him. Mm-hmm. And I often think about how we try to do things for folks. And I was with a group of inner city folks working in the inner city, millennials. And I said, "You know, I really want to be in there and do stuff for you guys." And they looked at me and they said, "Well, we don't need you to do stuff for us. We don't even need you to do stuff to us. Yeah. What we really long for is that you would do stuff with us."
Yeah.
And that feels like what happened next in your story as you pick up that thread with Denver.
Yes. After I asked him to be my friend, he said he would think about it. A week passed, and I drove through the inner city to go pick him up and take him to get some coffee. And just, we were beginning a friendship by then. And I was trying to see him on a regular basis. So I pulled up and he was taking trash out of a dumpster and feeding the wild animals and birds on the streets. And I said, would you like to go get some coffee? And he said, yeah, I guess so. So he gets in the car and we go to Starbucks and we're sitting on the sidewalk at Starbucks on a nice afternoon. He said, I've been thinking a lot about what you asked me. And I said, what did I ask you that required any thought? And he said, well, you asked me if I'd be your friend. And I said, oh, yes, I did. So what do you think about that? And he said, well, there's something I heard about white folks, and it really bothers me, and it's got to do with fishing. And I said, well, Denver, I'm not a fisherman. I said, I'm a rancher and cowboy and an art dealer, and I know a little bit about those things, but I don't even own a rod and reel or a tackle box, so I'm not sure I can answer your question. And he looked at me, and he said, oh, I bet you can. And I said, well, go ahead and ask. He said, okay. He said, I heard when white folks go fishing, they do this thing they call catch and release. And I said, oh, Denver, of course they do. I started laughing. I said, it's a sport. You don't get it. He said, no, sir, I don't get that at all. He said, because back on the plantation where I grew up in Louisiana, we'd go out in the morning, we'd dig us a can full of worms, we'd cut us a cane pole, we'd sit on the riverbank all day long. When we finally got something on our line, we were really proud of what we caught, and we'd take it back to the plantation and share it with all the folk. He said, so it occurred to me, if you're just a white man fishing for a friend and you're going to catch and release, man, got no desire to be your friend. And my mind flashed back to Debbie's dream of a poor man who was wise, because at that moment, what he spoke to me about friendship was the wisest thing I'd ever heard on friendship. And I only had a second to make up my mind. Do I accept this man's offer of friendship and not catch and release, or just be honest with him and say, I'm only doing this for Debbie. But if I ever heard from God in my life, it was at that moment. And I knew I had to take a chance and be his friend. And I said, okay, Denver, I'll be your friend and I will not catch and release. And then he said, then you got a friend for life. And I said, you do too. And so he became my professor.
Professor.
And I became his very eager student. And it was a life-changing friendship for me. You know, what I thought I was giving to him, I was not giving anything. I didn't really change his life. He began changing mine. And one of the first days that we became friends, and I'm sitting with him on the curb outside. He lived by this dumpster across the street from the homeless mission, what they call the hobo jungle. And we're sitting there, and he asked me, he said, are you one of them Christians? And I said, yes, I am. I said, why do you think I'm down here trying to help? He said, but that ain't my question. He said, my question is, I want to know why all you Christians worship one homeless man on Sunday, then turn your back on the very first one you see on Monday.
How did that affect you? I mean, by the way, you channeled Denver beautifully. Well, he passed away several years ago, but
yeah, six
I feel
years
like
ago,
I'm in
the
room
yeah.
with Denver, and I've never even met him. How did that affect you when you started hearing that wisdom, and it was almost like holding a mirror up to
Well,
you?
It became one of the most exciting things in my life. I couldn't wait to be with him almost on a daily basis. I began thinking so much less about art. And I guess in the old college terms, I moved from art to humanity. And his wisdom was so extraordinary that I couldn't wait to be with him almost on a daily basis. You know, I asked him one day, I said, what's it really like to be homeless? And he looked at me and he said, well, I don't know. Why don't you tell me? And I said, well, I mean, I've never been homeless. I don't know how to answer that question. He said, let me tell you something, Mr. Ron. And he looked at me and pointed and he said, whether we's rich, and then he pointed him back at himself. And he said, or whether we poor or something in between. He said, this earth ain't no final resting place. He said, so in a way, we all homeless. Just working our way home. So that's why I titled our new book that I wrote about Denver called Working Our Way Home.
I mean, at some level, Ron, your experience with Denver is so life-changing. It's a gift that you're able to share it with the world. I'm grateful that you invited me into being a part of that. And now your new book is coming. it's the 10 years after Same Kind of Different as Me. Talk a little bit about that book, Working Our Way Home.
Well, I guess I need to tell a little bit more of the other story first, because 5 months into our friendship, Denver told me, he said, something bad's getting ready to happen to Miss Debbie. And
I remember driving by the restaurant, he told you that.
Yeah.
And you said, that's what Denver told me.
That's where, yeah.
I haven't been back since.
And I said, that's where he told me something bad was getting ready to happen to Miss Debbie. He said, what Miss Debbie is doing for the homeless in Fort Worth, she has become precious to God. He said, when you become precious to God, you become important to Satan. He said, watch your backside. Something bad getting ready to happen. Mm. And 3 days later, she was diagnosed with cancer. And some doctors thought she might only live 6 months. Some thought maybe a year. But the good news is she lived 19 months after the diagnosis. But during that 19 months, the man that I thought had nothing to offer me in a friendship stayed up all night long on his knees in prayer for me and Miss Debbie and for our family. And he would knock on our door the next morning and deliver us a fresh, relevant message that he had gleaned from hours on his knees at night by the dumpster. And he would give it to us as it was, a revelation from God. And he was never wrong. Mm. And I used to marvel thinking, how is it here, a wealthy man, well-connected in the Christian world, and yet God chose the poorest, most dangerous, illiterate, homeless man on the streets of Fort Worth, Texas, to become the one who encouraged us the most during the darkest days of our lives. But if you think about it, isn't that just like God?
Mm-hmm. So upside down.
So on the last day of her life, he came to tell us, Mr. Ron, God's taking her home tonight. And he said, I want a few minutes with Miss Debbie. So he went in and he kneeled beside her bed and he said, Miss Debbie, I know the only reason you've been hanging on this long because you don't know who's going to take care of God's people. That was her name for the homeless. But he said, you don't know who's going to take care of God's people when you leave to go, when you pass. And he said, but I was talking to God last night and God told me, he said, Denver, you go tell Miss Debbie to lay down her torch and you pick it up and you carry it for the rest of your life. Mm. He said, so that's what I'm going to do, Miss Debbie, so you can go on to heaven. He kneeled beside her bed and he kissed Debbie on the forehead and said, I'll see you on the other side, Miss Debbie. And he came out of the room and he told me, he said, don't worry, Mr. Ron, ain't nothing going to end that God don't let something new begin. He said, something good's gonna happen. And I went in to see Debbie, and her final words to me were, don't give up on Denver. God is gonna bless your friendship in a way you can never imagine. Mm. And so 3 days later, she went on to be to heaven that night. And 3 days later, Denver showed up to preach her service quite spontaneously. And he went to the dais in the pulpit and began speaking. He spoke for almost 30 minutes, and it was one of the most powerful messages I've ever heard in my life. And when he got through, he got a standing ovation from a church with more than 1,000 people in attendance. And by noon the next day, more than $500,000 came in to begin building the new mission of her dreams. Within a year, $5 million. Within 3 years, $11 million. And now, 18 years later, we've raised nearly $47 million and completed the finest homeless mission in all of America in Fort Worth, Texas, where the chapel is named, the Deborah Hall Memorial Chapel. Mm. But anyway, after she died, and keeping my promise to Debbie, Denver moved in with me. And he and I lived together then for the next 10 and a half years. And together, it was quite challenging taking a man who had been living on the streets and in a dumpster for 25 years to move into a multi-million dollar home and learn how to live and coexist. And so this new book, Working Our Way Home, is how we learned to love and live together, and how together we traveled across America raising nearly $100 million for the homeless in over 800 appearances, telling our story and raising money, and how he was honored at the White House and in many state houses by governors.
Tell a story about when you and Denver went to the White House with the Bush family.
Yes, well, it's interesting how our book became the favorite book of Barbara Bush, who by then was the first lady. But at that time, it was George W. Bush and Laura Bush were in the White House. But they all had read our book and decided that they wanted us to come speak on behalf of Barbara Bush's foundation in Washington, D.C. at the Symphony Center, that Denver called the Sympathy Center. He didn't know what a symphony was, and he just thought they were saying Sympathy Center. And so they honored us with a private luncheon in the White House, in the president and Laura Bush's living quarters on the third floor. And all the Bush family members were there and a couple of other authors that were speaking that night. And as we were about to finish the lunch, Denver started banging on his glass with his fork, ding, 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 ding. And he was sitting between Laura Bush and Barbara Bush. And I was down at the other end by the old President Bush. And Laura Bush said, "I think Denver has something he'd like to say to us." And he said, "Yes, ma'am, I sure do." And she said, "Well, what would you like to say, Denver?" He said, "Well, first of all, I'd like to tell y'all that y'all got a real nice house here. I ain't never been in no house like this. And y'all got a real, I bet y'all are proud of your house." And Laura Bush said, "Well, Denver, it's not our house. It's your house, too." And he looked at her like a cow looking at a new gate. And he said, "Ain't my house. I ain't never had no house." And she said, "Oh, well, you know what I mean, Denver. It belongs to all the citizens and taxpayers of America." And he said, "I ain't never paid no taxes either." But anyway, everybody was laughing. But he said, "That ain't what I wanted to say." And she said, "Well, tell us what you want to say." And he said, "Well, what I would really like to do is be able to go around this table and thank each and every one of y'all by name." He said, "But I'm going to tell y'all the truth. He said, I can't remember none of y'all's names because all white folks look alike to me."
Oh, dear.
And I thought, oh, my goodness, I would die. But they thought it was the funniest thing they ever had heard. And I guess about an hour later, when we were finally leaving the White House, and as we pulled away from the White House in the limousine that they had us driven around in, and we're pulling away from the White House, and Denver starts laughing hysterically, and I was still kind of upset and angry with him for having embarrassed me in front of the whole Bush family. And I said, "Well, what's so dang funny, Denver? You just embarrassed the tar out of me in front of the whole Bush family. Now, what is so funny?" He said, "Well, think about it, Mr. Ron." He said, "I done gone from living in the bushes to eating with the bushes." He said, "God bless America. This is a great country." I said, "It sure is."
That is so good. That is so good. Well, Ron, thank you. Thank you for your friendship. Thank you for telling your story and keeping to tell your story. I want you to just give a few Denverisms for us before we close up.
Oh, well, listen, there
if you'll go and get a copy of Working Our Way Home, you'll get a bookmark with Denverisms in it. But like one of my favorites is "bless the hell out of people."
Well, you know, I was struggling with my relationship with my father. Mm-hmm. And my father was not an easy guy to get along with. And he was kind of an old racist, and he didn't really like Denver. So Denver told me one day, he said, "Mr. Ron, you just got to bless the hell out of your daddy." And he said, "Your daddy got a lot of hell in him." And he said, "That's the only way you change people, is you just got to bless the hell out of them." And so I began blessing the hell out of him, and Denver began blessing the hell out of him. And he and Denver became best friends, and my father became a believer as a result of the love and blessing the hell out of him. And so he ended up in heaven.
He has so many of these great ones. Well, again, if you're interested in finding out more about Ron's new book, Working Our Way Home, go to workingourwayhome.com, and you can get a personalized autographed copy, plus help the foundation, the Same Kind Foundation, which is the 911 for homeless shelters across America. Take a look at what you can do there and make a difference in your life, in your community's life, and enjoy the next chapter of Same Kind of Different as Me. Ron Hall, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Man, I just love that so much. What a great way to kick off our very first episode. I mean, he is just so honest and raw about his experiences, and
I think that, you know, that quality is something that we can all learn from for sure.
Yeah, so true, Alyssa. I just appreciate you all listening in to my conversation with Ron Hall. I love this guy. I love his heart. Mm-hmm. I love how he admits to his failures, his arrogance, and how that moved him to compassion, to keeping promises, mm-hmm. to turning his story, which had no chapter titles, into a story called Same Kind of Different as Me. And then his mm-hmm. book that just came out following the 10 years between Debbie's death and Denver's death is called Working Our Way Home, which is the incredible true story of that homeless ex-con and that grieving millionaire, Ron Hall, as they were thrown together to save each other. And I'm grateful for my relationship. And I'm glad you could listen in to a little bit. And if you haven't watched the movie or read the book, please jump in and do that. Or if you'd like to learn more about the Same Kind of Different as Me Foundation, go to samekindfoundation.org. Well, you've been listening to Mark P. Fisher and Alyssa Wilkinson on Inspiring Growth, where we inspire growth with leaders and their organization. If you'd like to learn more about us and what we do, just go to inspiringgrowth.biz. That's inspiringgrowth.biz. I also want to thank our sponsor today, eHome Counseling. You know, it's been observed, and I can attest to this, that oftentimes difficult roads lead to beautiful destinations. If you need someone to help you make sense of a difficult road that you're in right now, please set an appointment with an eHome counselor. Your first video session is only $25. Go to ehomecounseling.com. I'm Mark P. Fisher, the Chief Encourager with Inspiring Growth.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for listening to our very first episode of Inspiring Growth. We would love for you to just take a moment before you exit out of whatever podcast platform you are listening to us on and make sure that you subscribe, tell your friends. We would love for them to hear this conversation as well. And hopefully you are leaving us encouraged and inspired. Have a great day.